texts talk about how the internet started out as a decentralized process, and through the process of capitalization of the internet, the process of capital coming in and becoming the major player in its development, it became more centralized. And often people don't think about the path information takes when they communicate. They just think that it's coming from me to that person. They don't really think about so much in between. Well, by putting you in between, by making it a phone tree where you actually have to receive the information and pass the information on, this to us very clearly kind of helps people think of information and how it flows through networks. And you know that when you get a message, you're not obliged necessarily to pass it on. You can change it, you can invent your own message, or you can just simply refuse to pass it on, right? In the same way that centralized platforms have that kind of power when you communicate through them. There's also an interesting social economic dimension to the platform, in that the mobile phones are the most common technology in the world. More people have access to mobile phones than any other medium, so it's a very ubiquitous technology. It's available everywhere. But nonetheless, the relationships with the networks are very much asynchronous. For instance, in the West, mobile phones are sort of marketed very much as a freedom-enabling device, where you have your mobile phone, you can be anywhere, call anybody, communicate everybody. So, like, you know, especially early mobile phone advertising had a lot of, like, businessmen doing their work on the beach and stuff like that, because, you know, just so this freedom kind of a platform. Where in a lot of parts of the world, like especially the poorer parts of the world, people have mobile phones, but they don't actually have any credit. So actually, they can't make any phone calls. They carry the phone not to enable their own freedom, but because their parents, their employers, their teachers, the authority figures in their lives insist that they carry the phone so they can control them. Right? So they're actually control devices that tether the people to their masters, so to speak, to their superiors. And so this aspect is also very interesting in R15N, because all the phone calls are incoming calls. So actually R15N can be used whether or not you have any phone credit. So it's a broadcast communication system that doesn't require you to have any phone credit. It is, of course, an economic fiction, like all the work. So all of the networks there that we've created that I'll touch on briefly, not as much depth, because R15N is the exhibition today. But we call a lot of our works economic fiction, because they're not science fiction. They work, technologically speaking, they function. So the science is not the fictional part. But just like in science fiction, for the science and science fiction to become a reality, the science has to transcend its conditions of the period when the fiction was written. So for the things in science fiction to become real, science has to transcend the state of when the original work was imagined. In the same way, these are economic fictions. In order for them to exist, we have to transcend our current economic limitations, because these systems, being free, being open, and being against the social economic model that capitalism imposes on communication mechanisms, cannot exist because they cannot be funded outside of this art context. So they're a form of fiction. They can exist here and for us and in these playful environments, but these kinds of topologies that we experiment with are actually fictional. Another one is Thimble. It's the one with the finger. Thimble was shown in at Transmediale last year. It was our contribution last year. And Thimble is a microblogging platform. Does everybody here know what a microblogging platform is, like Twitter? Right, so there's a lot of people thinking about decentralized microblogging platforms or decentralized social media in general. And from our point of view, the internet was always decentralized. Right, the whole point of the internet is a decentralized social platform. That's actually what it is. And things like Usenet and IRC and Finger and email have been allowing people to share photos and post status updates and share information for the entire time the internet has existed. So the question is not really how to build a decentralized social media platform. The question rather is, how did we wind up with decentralized platforms? Like, how did we wind up with, like, from starting from a totally decentralized social media platform called the internet, which is what it is, how did we wind up with Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, these very centralized platforms? And the answer, of course, is the logic of capitalism, which we'll go over in more detail later. But so Thimble demonstrates this by creating a decentralized social media platform using protocols from the 1970s. So it's based around the Finger protocol, which was how status updates hosted on the internet in the 1970s. Finger started out as a campus area user information system, where people updated their .project.plan files to post status updates, much the way we do with Twitter right now, and then eventually became a distributed TCP-based service, which is the state that it still remains. So the actual finger daemon that we use for our own ThimbleHost is like hasn't had a single like software update in like over a decade. It's very stable. And DeadSwap is another one of the platforms that we did at the Aarhus University at the Surveillance Festival, and it is meant to sort of be an analysis and a critique of circumvention systems, because the topic of the festival was surveillance, and in the hacker community, the media arts community, there's a lot of projects that attempt to create circumvention systems, projects like Tor. And other kinds of things that imagine themselves as allowing people to escape the surveillance of their oppressive regimes, so they can kind of like organize revolution in secret spaces and, you know, destroy Death Star. And this is for me a problematic understanding of activism and a problematic understanding of how difficult it is to actually be secret. So we created a platform to kind of help people get that. And it's a file sharing system that only exists on one USB stick. And you take this USB stick and you can upload files to it and you can download files from it. And there's a little wiki where you can post messages and update files. When you take this USB stick and you hide it somewhere in public space, so under a garbage can somewhere, under a park bench, in the corner of a cafe, then you send a text message to an anonymous text message interface. You say where you've hidden it, and then this text message is forwarded to the next person in the network. So the next person is supposed to interact with it, and then they get this text message, and they have to go and find it, and then they can upload and download files, and so on. And then they send a text message where it is. So it's a dark net, but it's a very physical one. And it sounds really kind of easy, but people find out that it's actually really very hard to be a good secret agent. Right, so the Plan Manifesto is this book here. It's also available. It's also available online. And this is more or less what we're going to talk about now. So we often use the word communism in the wrong place, right? We often use the word communism in our work, and it's important to understand what we mean by that. And communism does not refer to the form of government of historical or contemporary communist states. Even the leaders of those states would never have claimed that those were communist states. They would only have claimed they were attempting to achieve communism, and they never have. So communism is not a place that ever existed, but it's a theoretical society. It's a theoretical society with no classes and no state. And it's one that's never been achieved. That's what it means in theory. So it doesn't refer to any story. The term originates in the British and French collectivist popular movements, such as followers of Robert Owen. In the beginning, it was a very kind of primitive movement without any kind of really strong social theory. It was more or less this idea of cooperatives, people working together, like starting their own like cooperative textile mills, like Robert Owen did, and things like that. So it was very open concept that just more or less meant together owning things together, as opposed to having like a relationship where somebody else owns the things that you need to live and work. And likewise, capitalism does not refer to the free market, enterprise, business, entrepreneurship, or liberal democracy, despite the fact that it's often used that way in the media. It doesn't mean any of those things. Capitalism refers to a society in which the owners of capital are able to abstain from direct production by appropriating the products of workers who employ their property in production. So capitalism is a mode of production, and it implies a relationship between workers and capitalists. So the capitalists own things that the workers need in order to produce and share, and they are able to earn income by doing so. That's how we use the word. We're not talking about any country or any particular place. Right, and capitalism was not invented by Forbes magazine, and it was not invented in a positive sense. Capitalism was actually invented as a critical term. It originates from libertarian socialists, the early critics of political economy, and it was intended to draw a correlation with feudalism. So the Ricardian socialists were the first people to begin to formulate a kind of a scientific socialism or communism. They followed the works of David Ricardo, and they took his interpretations, and they applied it. David Ricardo was a capitalist, and remember, capitalism was once itself a contesting class. It was once itself an underclass that was contesting for supremacy against feudalism. So the early capitalists were themselves critical thinkers, in a sense, because they were criticizing the feudal class. And so David Ricardo constructed a theory of class struggle where he illustrated how the landlord, the interests of the landlord class were against the interest of everybody else. And what the early Ricardian socialists did was they took that model, the Ricardian model, and they turned it around. They said, well, if the landlords are exploiting everybody by owning land, the capitalists are also exploiting everybody by owning capital. And the word capitalism was derived from that. It was meant to draw a relationship with feudalism. So it was a negative term from the start. It was never used in a positive way until quite recent. Here's a quote from Thomas Hodgkins, one of the Ricardian socialists, where he lays out the essential arguments that socialism and communism comes from. The lawgiver and the capitalist always compare our wages with the wages of other laborers, and without referring to what we produce. So the theory that the working class produces a surplus value that is appropriated by capital, and that they're paid not based on the value that they create, but based on their replacement costs, based on what it costs to sustain them as workers. That's the argument that you see Thomas Hodgkins laying up here. No, that's 1825. Right. So both economies and networks are composed of relationships. That's what Chana mentioned earlier. A network is a set of relationships. An economy is also a set of relationships, just like a network. And relationships in a network define the topology of a network. So when we talk about the topology of a network, what we mean is what are the relationships between the various things that interact on that network. Okay? Relationships in an economy define the mode of production. So when you talk about a mode of production, you're talking about what are the relationships between the various actors within that economic system. In networking, we talk about various different kinds of network topologies. I'm going to focus on two broad kinds because this is not meant to educate you on networking, but most theoretical types. So a mesh network is a network where all participants can interact, where every participant on that network can interact with every other network, without any mediation, which means that any node that happens to be in between those two nodes doesn't in any way interfere with that information. It just passes it through directly, and often there's not even often they can communicate directly with each other without any node in the middle at all. But the network just simply passes information between all participants in a neutral fashion. The internet is such a network, right? Authorization in this kind of a network is always based on mutual configuration, because without any centralization, what can be exchanged, what kind of interactions can take place between the nodes of the network are subject to the configuration of both those things. So the mutual approval of this kind of interaction is wanted by both sides. Right? And each participant is autonomous. So each participant in the network is completely in control of their own host, their own information, their own communication systems. Now star networks are different kinds of networks. A star network is called a star network because it has a center node, and all of the other participants are like rays of the star extending from the center node, and they all come into the center node. So all communication has to go through that center node, right? So all interactions between participants is mediated. No two participants on that network can communicate except through that central node, right? Just like we're talking about R15N, when the message comes through you, have complete control of whether to pass that message on. In a star network, there's one node on a tree. It's a star, so there's one node where all information goes through, and that node always has the right to approve or deny any kind of communication between the network, to track what's going on, to allow or deny storage of information or access to information. Right? And authorization is, of course, always granted by the operator of that middle node. So the operator of the network can control who is authorized to do what. Right? And each participant is dependent on the operator. So the participants can only do what the operator allows. Now communism, back to modes of production, Is a network or operate as a concern equal? Or is an economy operate as a concern equal? Producers retain everything they produce. Participants produce for social value and not an exchange value. So things are made because they're considered to be useful by the people that make them, not because they have value in exchange, because there's no profits being extracted. And exchange is based on mutual respect. So it's not based on profit, they're based on mutual respect. Right? And in capitalism, participants are divided into classes. Property owners appropriate wealth from producers. And participants produce for exchange value. So the logic of capitalism, because investors invest money in order to capture profit, is that what they invest in needs to capture exchange in order for them to recuperate their investment and thus reproduce their capital. And exchange is based on market price. So price mediates how things are exchanged. Okay? So capitalists love star networks. Because in a star network, the capitalist roles and credentials create classes. If you have an account on a central system, you know that some people are administrators, some people have different rights. So by having a centralized platform, you end up with classes of users that have different privileges based on what they've been assigned by the operator. And mediation is required to charge a price. If there's no ability to interact, to come in between the users, if you can't control their interaction and their data, you also can't monetize that relationship. In order to charge a price, you have to be in the middle of the relationship, which a star network allows you to do. Right? Capitalists hate mesh networks because participants can interact directly, so there's no place for the cash box, there's no place for the doorman or the cover charge. Right? There's no toll gates, no prices. And there's no privilege, no control. You can't stop participants from interacting with each other. So you can't have a set of privileges that differentiate them from each other. Right? So the internet. We all know the internet. We've probably been using it for many years. The internet was not created by capitalists. It was developed by universities, NGOs, hobbyists, and military. And of course, all of those people were not creating for exchange value, right? They were creating because they needed it. Even the military, even if they needed for evil things like killing people, they still were not creating it for exchange value. They were creating it for their needs, their communication needs, right? But capitalists weren't just doing nothing. They weren't sitting idly aside. Capitalists were also actively excited about the potential of online systems. They created something called online services, which some of you may remember as being called CompuServe, AOL, Prodigy. These were huge platforms in the early 90s and earlier that were used by all kinds of people, were very well funded, had lots of money, huge data centers, and briefly were very, very important. Right? Until the 90s, major corporations had no real internet strategy, because to them, this was the online world. CompuServe, AOL, Prodigy. This internet stuff was something that students were using in universities, and it was for hobbyists and NGOs. It wasn't serious business. Right? But capitalist online services were client-server systems that employed star topology. Right? The internet was host to numerous peer-to-peer systems, such as email, Usenet, IRC, which depend on a mesh topology. So in the 90s, both these systems kind of existed side by side. You had the capitalist world investing and developing CompuServe, AOL, Prodigy, and those sorts of things. And then you had this kind of non-capitalist world, this strange alliance of people that needed different communication tools to solve different problems, that were creating this kind of hodgepodge internet. Now, because the internet is a peer system, anybody with a connection to it can also connect others. That's one of the powerful things about the way the internet was built, is that anybody with a connection to the internet can connect everybody else on the internet too, because of the way TCP/IP works, and the DNS system, and everything else, right? And so all this created a boom of internet service providers, because the relative cost, the relative capital required to open an internet service provider was really very small. So all of a sudden, they just exploded in every street corner. And this caught the capitalists totally by surprise. They were not expecting this, because they were like, what is this silly internet? We have, we've spent millions of dollars on CompuServe and AOL and Prodigy. Who wants this? But yet, because of the very structure of the network, it had explosive growth. Okay. And it's former said the exchange value these ISVs were capturing was collectively created. So the actual economics of the internet, the early internet, was much different than what we had on CompuServe, AOL, and stuff like that. Right? The value of the network comes from the size of the network, because people want to be on a network where other people are on. So the more other people are on the network, the more value that network has. Right? Now, communism loves a mesh network. Each ISP was independently earning income by being a part of a common platform, not owned by anybody as a whole, but composed of the mutual interactions of the participants. Okay? So this does not resemble a market economy, but rather a network economy. Unlike AOL and Prodigy, which competed against each other based on investing in tools. So like AOL might say, we're better than CompuServe because we have better chat, or we have better messaging system, or something like that. They would have their own programmers, they would invest money into differentiating themselves from the other online services. Whereas the ISPs were selling the same internet. There was no difference between the internet one ISP was selling or the internet another ISP was selling. They were just selling access to the internet. And the value of the internet was not from what any one ISP was contributing to it, but from the size of the network that all of these interconnected ISPs had created.